Sid Drouse has been a colleague of Pete's since the 1950s, when they were professors in the physics department before they both moved to SLAC at its beginnings in 1962-63. He's a theoretical physicist and served as deputy for both Peef and Burt from 1969 until he retired 10 years ago.
You've heard from the previous speakers about the humanity and warmth of Peef, the integrity and the commitment to principle that were the hallmark of his life, and that earned him universal respect above and beyond the admiration for Peef as a great physicist and the creator and masterful director of this great laboratory. I would like to illustrate Peef's deep commitment to principle and his determination to achieve goals that he greatly valued by recounting several of his battles in Washington. They are responsible for the fact that SLAC exists. They also illustrate his important contribution to keeping the peace in our world, heavily armed as it is with nuclear weapons of unparalleled, unimaginable destructive potential. It was a campaign he waged up until his death on Monday. I first met Peef in 1951. That was 56 years ago when he arrived at Stanford, and I was here temporarily for my very first job as an instructor in the physics department. His move here to Stanford typifies his commitment to basic principles. What triggered Peef's move to Stanford was a requirement to sign a loyalty oath to the United States Constitution that was imposed upon the faculty and other employees of the University of California. Those early 1950s were the heydays of security witch hunts and investigations into communist subversion by congressional un-American activity committees. This requirement to sign such a special loyalty oath affirming lack of communist contamination, as Peef called it, caused a major disruption at Cal. A number of faculty members quit and others were fired for refusing to sign. There was no question about Peef's loyalty. He had security clearances to work on the atomic bomb project at Los Alamos during the war. He did sign the oath, very reluctantly, but then resigned, saying the oath was wrong in principle, and the situation there had become simply intolerable for him. Incidentally, subsequently, the courts ruled that requiring that oath was illegal, and it was thrown out, but Stanford won. It was a great good fortune for Stanford that he chose to move here as a professor of physics. Subsequently, he also became director of the High Energy Physics Lab, as you heard it earlier. Peef was also a very popular professor of physics for his excellent lectures, patience, and accessibility, creating the same open collegial relationship with students that he nurtured for all of us here at SLAC. As anyone who knows Peef has learned, and you've heard some of this already, he can be very persuasive. In addressing an issue, he did his homework, and he knew what he was talking about. And those who dealt with him knew they were up against a fundamental, powerful force of nature. This was true at SLAC on detailed technical issues, such as the alignment of the accelerator, as well as in Washington and his activities there, where they're dealing with nuclear bomb testing or support for science. Peef was deeply engaged as a major mover and shaker of all stages of such issues, and he was frequently up at 30,007 feet or so en route to Washington, Moscow, Geneva, Rome, Beijing, or whatever. During the Eisenhower administration, Peef headed up the White House Technical Working Group dealing with methods for detecting nuclear explosions in space. This was the early step en route to a treaty banning testing of nuclear weapons above ground or in the oceans that could cause environmental damage or radioactive fallout harmful to humans. The results of peace study were presented by President Eisenhower in diplomatic negotiations with the Germans, with the Russians in 1959, it goes back a long time, in which Pete participated as chairman of the U.S. team in one of the technical negotiations with Soviet counterparts. That was a tough challenge, to say the least, but the agreement was reached and provided the first basic step toward subsequent signing of the Limited Test Ban Treaty of 1963 that restricted all testing to underground sites. He contributed much more work on test limits that continued for the next 35 years, leading up to the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty signed by the United States in 1996 and by almost all nations of the world, and ratified by 140 of them, although not yet by this country, as Pete was distressed by. Even though it is not yet officially enforced, I want to add, all nuclear powers except North Korea last year are complying with this treaty. Pete's prominence and importance in this work to try and control the nuclear arms race and save the world from nuclear holocaust drew attention from among other national journals, Playboy magazine. It goes back to June 1977, and if you don't believe me, there's a famous statement of Ring Lardner. You could look it up. You'll find reference to, quote, Dr. Panofsky may be the brightest man in the world, quote, and then they go on to say, quote, he is 5 feet 2 inches tall, weighs 150 pounds, neither smokes nor drinks, and is manifestly, painfully indifferent to clothes. I continue. Not that he's a nudist. Just that his mind is on higher things. Playboy then went on to talk about others of Pete's charms that qualified for him appearing in that magazine. One of them being, and I quote, he built a straight 10,000-foot-long vacuum pipe that is housed in a heavy concrete casing some 25 feet underground that has no practical use whatsoever. Playboy also called him a key figure in the Strangelove business. I'm sure you all remember Dr. Strangelove. They said he is smarter than the rest, among whom they included Edward Teller, with whom he had many major disagreements. And finally, the magazine concluded, he therefore has helped the government avoid potentially embarrassing and crushing boo-boos. I can personally vouch for that statement's accuracy. I only wish that his views had been accepted and acted upon more frequently than they were. We'd be in better shape today in the world facing the dangers of nuclear weapons if they had listened to him. The diary of George Kistiakowsky, special assistant to President Eisenhower for science and technology through 1959 and 1960, gives you another picture of Pete as a persistent and committed fighter for something he believes in and really wants. That was the period when the decision whether to build SWAC was being debated in the highest halls of government. It was being opposed by very strong forces in the East who 50 years ago didn't yet fully appreciate what a wonderful world there was west of the Hudson River. The great I.I. Rabi, among many others, strongly opposed constructing big accelerators out here in California. And furthermore, they believed that proton machines rather than electron accelerators were the way to go because they could reach higher energy. Some even in the debate condemned SWAT as premature, unwise, and probably useless to high energy physics. Up against this situation and the fact that the chief advisory panel on high energy physics for the Atomic Energy Commission and the President's Science Advisory Committee, on which he served, could not reach a unanimous consensus, the fate of SWAT was hanging perilously in the balance. You all know we exist here, so you know, you must know, that Pete fought hard and with all his strength and won. His credibility and extraordinarily high respect that he earned in the White House with President Eisenhower personally for his important contributions on issues of nuclear weapons and peace were critical to Pete's success in getting the go-ahead for SLAC. I also have the impression that to some extent, in the end, the victory was aided somewhat by the desire of some of our detractors back there just to get Pete out of their hair. Exile him away 3,000 miles to California. After Pete gained White House support for SLAC, his struggles were far from over. Monumental political and self-imposed barriers of principle remain. One battle of principle that is not widely known, I want to mention. It was waged by Pete with the strong and critical support of this university, including in this the president of the university then, Wally Sterling, and the chairman of the Board of Trustees, Dave Packard, backed them all the way. They rejected the insistence by the Atomic Energy Commission, the earlier incarnation of the Department of Energy, for a requirement in the contract for SLAC that Pete describes with the following words in his forthcoming book, entitled Panofsky on Physics, Politics, and Peace, Pete Remembers. And these are the words. The AEC insisted on a provision that would require Stanford to undertake any work at SLAC in the national interest, which the AEC deemed necessary. This provision was intended to compel the university to have SLAC undertake classified military work when demanded to do so by the Atomic Energy Commission. I, that is Pete talking, I'm quoting, consider this to be unacceptable. That is, he felt that had to be a mutual informed decision, not a unilaterally one imposed. And he went on to tell the authorities, with the university's backing, that this would be an impossible condition for the university to accept. Even though he was warned that this would cost them the project, the largest one at that time, he and Stanford remained firm and they prevailed. We all won by that display of courage, including other universities who had previously complied with such a directive, which was subsequently dropped. If that isn't an example of staying true to principle, shoving $114 million in 1962 dollars back across the table after 5 years of hard work to get it, then I don't know what is. Pete was awarded with just about every conceivable honor that science and the U.S. government can give because of his wisdom, his devotion both to science and peace, and simply as a national resource and as a giant of a person. Major foreign academies of science accorded him the distinguished status of honorary foreign membership, not only for what he'd done for science, but for what he had done for their programs. This includes China, Russia, France, and Italy. It would be wrong to conclude that in spite of all his achievements, the Nobel Prize eluded Pete. I would put it differently. It was Pete who bypassed the Nobel Prize by his dedicated commitment in two personal crusades. One was the creation and management of this great laboratory, whose extraordinary achievements during his leadership garnered three Nobel Prizes for five of our colleagues, events that brought him the greatest of pleasure. The second crusade was his deep patriotism and devotion to the United States, national security, and world peace, an activity to which he devoted his life until the last day he was with us. Thank you.
Pete spent the last day of his life at the laboratory he loved, talking accelerator physics and discussing the challenges of running a laboratory. We all will miss Pete, but we are all so very glad we have the privilege of knowing him. Thank you for joining us.